we're going to be talking shortly, we hope, with David Heap. And I'll just tell you that David Heap's project is the quite well known, I hope, to our listeners, CanadaBoatGaza.org, often identified in this way, best way to end the blockade of Gaza. And it's he is a member of the Canada Boat to Gaza. And there is a project, Support the Freedom Flotilla 3, freedomflotilla.org. And we are joined, I believe, by David Heap. How are you, David?
Hi, Phil. Good to speak to you again.
Well, it's nice to talk to you. You, of course, a member of the unseekable Heap family and always at the forefront of things. You have persisted. People thought, well, this will go away, but it's springtime and there's talking about a freedom flotilla. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, we've been planning, and since you mentioned my folks, we're reminded by people who see the Selma film this year that 50 years ago my dad was among the people, before he was a politician or anything, he was a factory worker at the time, was one of the people who answered the call to go to Selma.
Did he?
And one of the people, when after the first march got broken up from Selma to Montgomery, mm-hmm. and MLK put out a call, dad was a clergy person as well, right? So a member of the clergy, come join us in Selma, and he had a leave from his factory job, and he went. But they didn't know at that time that they were going to have that dramatic turnaround following the Selma to Montgomery march, and I think the thing that people keep in mind is the point is not to go once, the point is to keep on going, right? And the Freedom Riders kept on going, the folks who walked with African Americans against segregation kept on going, right? Yes. And the connection that brings this together for me is when we were in Greece with the 2011 flotilla, Alice Walker, who of course was with the Freedom Riders those years ago in the American South, said this: the international campaign to break the end the blockade of Gaza, these are the freedom rides of our time. And you know, coming from somebody like Alice, that's a very powerful connection. That you're saying that we can't take all of the burden of the blockade and the occupation on ourselves. Obviously, the people in the front line are the Palestinians who live this day in, day out, decade in, decade out for far too long. But we can't forget them, right? And so the message is, you're not forgotten. The media of the world and the governments of the world are doing the best to forget about the blockade. We're going to keep putting it in the forefront. So again, with our flotilla partners, it started with a core of group of Europeans and some North Americans, but it's expanded. They're very excited this time. We've got the South African Palestine Solidarity Alliance involved, folks from New Zealand, so as well. So it's expanding. We've got all the Europeans that we had before, and some more from other continents and other places. I can't tell you exactly when it's going to leave, but we're saying in the first half.
We shouldn't
half
know
of,
that, right?
Yeah.
You guys
first
are
half of this
you're
year.
Freebooters or whatever they call them.
Yeah, well, we try to avoid too much specific publicity, or how many boats or exactly from where. But we will have a variety of people from civil society organizations in a number of countries.
Mm-hmm. And, and there's this website. I know there's a website, freedomflotilla.org. And then there's CanadaBoatGaza.org. And of course, I'm sorry, I was going to say, your projects, as always, you're diligently pursuing it. You're also asking people to, I guess they can go to the site and volunteer or help buy supplies. I recall that. I think that was our subject last time we spoke with you. And well, tell us about Gaza. Is the last time it was in the news, of course, it was horrible news. This was the shelling and the really massive loss of life. And my understanding is that the assistance that had been promised, everybody always, when there's bloodshed, there's great promises of help. But there's been quite a shortfall between the promises and delivery, has there not?
Yeah. So of the billions that were promised, a small fraction has actually arrived. And of course, Israel makes it, as an occupier, makes it as hard as possible to get supplies in and makes it as lucrative as possible for the occupation, because the occupation is, among other things, an economic proposition, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if a UN agency gets permission to buy from the occupier to buy cement, they have to buy cement from the occupier, right? So it's literally a captive market. I mean, a captive market which is dependent for everything on its occupier and can't develop any kind of economic sovereignty. So our last project, which got bombed and burned in July, the Gaza's Ark, was to sail out with products that people were buying. Those products still exist. Some of them, the food products we distributed because there were a lot of people who needed food aid after the war in the fall. But the non-food items, which is, you know, embroidery and traditional handicrafts, a lot of it made by women in refugee camps, those were hanging on to. And the people who purchased it, and again, from Australia to Norway, from Greece to Vancouver, right, people put up their money to say, we believe in the Palestinians of Gaza having a sovereign economy of their own. They said, we don't want it to go anywhere else. We want it to come to us when they have a free economy, when they have the ability to export. So they're hanging on to it. They hope to get it on this flotilla, because in 2008, boats got in and out, right? It's perfectly feasible to come out again with these exports.
Your shipping company will deliver.
Eventually.
As soon as that blockade
is broken.
Phil,
is solidarity. I mean, that's the most important cargo. Whatever else we have on board, it's the links between people, right? So your trade union, your student association, your faith group, your community group, your peace group in Canada or any of those other countries I mentioned is now connected to the folks that you're trying to buy from. And we're just using the goods are really, we're not really that a shipping company, right? But our goods are a way to put a human face on the people who are demonized in our media, right? Because these aren't just people who, send shells up in the air that try to reach their occupier, or they aren't just people whose homes get blown up. These are people who want to have a normal economic life like people in our community.
We're speaking to David Heap, and there is about the freedomflotilla.org. You can go to that site, and you can also go to canadaboatgaza.org. For more information, I hope everybody will support this project. Of course, there's been a dramatic election, and there's been also a previous and a sort of rather unprecedented negative exchange between some of the great powers and Mr. Netanyahu. How is that affecting things? Is it? Do you see a little glimmer of light on that front?
Well, it's hard to rejoice in things getting worse, but I think as a lot of people are saying that the label and the packaging is off, right? And you now see apartheid for what it really is. When Netanyahu runs his campaign saying there will be no Palestinian state, it's getting really hard for people in Washington and Ottawa to cling to this fiction that there's going to be a two-state solution when, you know, the occupier who holds all of the cards and all of the guns says it ain't going to happen and is elected with that mandate. So it has the tragic benefit of making things much, much clearer. As somebody said, it's like the toxic food label that tells you just all the bad stuff that's actually in the product that you just bought.
This might cause cancer.
This stuff definitely causes oppression, and there's no gilding the lily or trying to hide what it really is. Of course, our movements are people-to-people movements, right? So we stand in solidarity with the Palestinians trying to lead a normal life. And when you say it's out of the news, of course, that means that the shooting stopped in one direction. It didn't. It slows down in the other direction, but the Israeli military continues to shoot Palestinians and target their homes day in, day out, week in, week out. I mean, the fishing boats can't fish without being attacked, and
people can't farm
their land without being attacked.
A recent loss of life there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
The fisherman, he was outside they have 3 miles that they're able to go out?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have the 20 miles that they were supposed to have under the Oslo Accords. They don't have the 12 miles.
So Oslo says 20.
Oslo said 20, and that was rolled back to 12, which is one of the statutory normal limits for territorial waters. Then they rolled back to 6 and then to 3, and it briefly went back up to 6 again, and they got some reasonable fish for a change, because, you know, this is subsistence fishery. It's a very important source of food in the Strip. But then they push back to 3. And even inside 3, they can be shot at and have their boats confiscated, their boats damaged. They get kidnapped taken to, imprisoned in Israel and interrogated and so forth and threatened. So it's a dangerous occupation to be a fisherman in Gaza. And it's very hard to feed your family, let alone your community. Similarly, you know, it should be an agricultural breadbasket. It used to be very productive, but so much of the agricultural land is torn up by the Israeli military or inaccessible because they shoot at people who are, you know, doing something really dangerous for the security of Israel, like planting a garden, growing food.
Well, now, Can you update us about this? We're hearing that that there's been, was it the Egyptian border that they are once a week or twice a week or something, they're allowing a certain amount of traffic? This is significant news, too, I assume.
Yeah. Well, Rafah is the border that was sort of working. So the one and only time I've actually gone to Gaza was during the previous regime, the Morsi government the elected Morsi government in Gaza, in Egypt, in 2012. It was almost a normal border. It wasn't really normal, but it was passed for normal. Since the coup, the military coup in June or July, August, 2013, things have gotten much, much worse at that border. And for long periods of time, it's just been closed completely. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly tragic. I mean, I hear from young people, and being an educator, I really feel for the ones who finish their studies, for example, and get a scholarship, or they're ready to enroll in an institution someplace else, and they literally can't get out. And they lose their scholarships, they lose their academic years. And that's just, I mean, it's just the students, but for me, that's the hope of a generation, sure. Right? If you take hope away from a generation of young people, the world shouldn't be surprised if they end up doing hopeless things. But that's also true of, you know, people who travel for health reasons or family reasons or business reasons. So that border, for the longest time, was staying more closed than open, and now there's these sort of, I hate to say regular, but periodic openings. But what you need to know is it's like an eyedropper. I mean, it's been through that gate. They really...
And it's subject to whim, right? I mean, it could be closed at any moment.
It's subject to the whim of a military government, let's face it. I mean, the whole Sinai in general and that border in particular are militarily controlled. The Egyptian military works hand in glove with the Israelis, mm-hmm. who, as an occupier, they control everything, including the civil registry. So if you don't have an ID that's recognized by the occupier, you're not going to get in or out, right? Mm-hmm. It's exactly. It's at whim once in a while. So, but it's basically an escape hatch. You know, it lets off the pressure once in a while, mm-hmm. but it's no way to run a normal economy or a normal education system or health or business or anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, as you
flooded
described,
the tunnels, so you can't get out that way, right?
To do business, I mean, you have to be able to predict. You know, that you can deliver something on a certain mm-hmm. date. If you can't, if you say, well, that's subject to change, well, who wants to do business with you?
Exactly.
So it's tough to do David business. Heath, by the way.
It's tough, yes. David Heath of Canadian Boat to Gaza, freedomflotilla.org, canadaboatgaza.org.
That's how I know you, Canada Boat to Gaza, yes. Canada Boat Gaza, yes.
Yeah, that's the website.
What about you had some legal disputes over boats. Are some boats still being held by the Israeli? What's the status of the boat?
There are. The Canadian boat, the Tahrir, was stolen in the high seas in November 2011. The Estelle, with a Canadian on board, with Jim Manley on board, was seized in October 2012. So this is a risky voyage, and that's one of the considerations when we prepare to do this. We know that there's a risk involved, a risk to human life and limb, but also a risk to the solidarity investment in buying these vessels. Mm-hmm. We challenge them as the best we can in court, but of course, the Israeli courts, the Canadian courts send us to the Israeli courts, and the Israeli courts don't have a lot of time for these cases, so it doesn't go very far in the legal system. But we know that the legal system isn't really our friends, right? Yeah. In any country,
but by the way, on that
important recourse.
If your boat was taken on the high seas outside, mm-hmm. you were not in Israeli waters,
not at all. No,
and you would think a court would say this is rather open and shut. This case doesn't belong in front of us because it wasn't taken in our waters.
That was a decision about one of the Israelis who was on the Israeli anti-Zionist activists who was on the Estelle. They tried to charge him with treason, and the judge said, didn't happen in Israel, didn't happen in Israeli waters, get him out of here. And he ended up being deported back to Sweden. But they don't usually get that far. You don't get to that hearing, basically. You don't get heard. Our cases mostly don't get heard. The Swedes did get the Estelle case heard, and it's still under appeal. Mm-hmm. We've decided that, I mean, our main voyage seems paradoxical, but we're sailing in that direction, but we're really pointing at Ottawa and back at Canada, right? So sailing towards Gaza is a way of navigating against the Harper government and against the pro-Zionist elite that basically occupies most of the political elite in this country, right? Mm-hmm. So we're sailing, only a few of us are on small boats.
Yeah, you're not endorsed by the leading parties of our country, as near as I can make out.
No, but despite the fact that there is, I would say...
The peace movement, yes.
a lot of people who are looking for some kind of political leadership on this, right? I mean, the folks who want to vote in favor of the occupation have got their choice of the old line parties. The party that figures out that there's a body of people in Canada in the electorate who want to vote for a human rights-based solution in Israel-Palestine, they're going to make some significant gains, because I meet people all the time who are looking for somebody they can vote for, and they're not finding it in federal politics in Canada.
Yeah, I agree with you. And by the way, that phenomenon happened within Israel itself. One of the surprising things was that the so-called party, what was it, the Arab List parties,
yep,
actually finally got together and showed themselves to be a significant force. Maybe undoubtedly, I would think the climate is, there's in Canada and North America, much more skeptical towards the leadership of in Israel, the United States, the way they've been trying to handle this. We're speaking to David Heap, GazaArc.org. You describe your work, of course, as people to people. What do your colleagues in Gaza and under those conditions? What is their morale like? What do they say?
Well, I'm in awe of what's called in Arabic sumud, the steadfastness of Palestinians in general. I mean, the fact that they can see their homes torn apart by bombs, and their schools and their mosques and their hospitals, their farms and their fishing boats, and then they can get up and say, we're going to fish again, we're going to plant more olive trees. I mean, these are acts of resistance, but they're also profoundly optimistic acts. Nobody plants olive trees for themselves. You plant olive trees for your grandkids, right? And they get torn up and they plant some more. So there's this a tremendous sense of attachment to the land and attachment to the cause. The main thing they say is, it's great that you're sailing here, but, and it's great that you're not forgetting us, but you got to change the politics in your country. This occupation is going to end when the nations of the world, the so-called international community, stops letting Israel behave in this way and starts holding them accountable. So even though, you know, people have difficulty with the Palestinian Authority, and for many good reasons, the fact that they're moving towards a position where Israel can be brought to the International Criminal Court is a very important step, and something we should demand of Canadian politicians is, well, if you believe in the rule of law, surely you believe that everybody should be accountable to the International Criminal Court, right? If Tom Mulcair says he's a great friend of Israel's, well, friends don't let friends break international law, right?
Exactly. He's a lawyer. He ought to know that. David Heap, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with, and hope you get support for the Freedom Flotilla, freedomflotilla.org. And you can, of course, go to gazaarc.org and join up and help out. Thank you very much.
Shout out to all the QP 3902 and 3903 strikers in your listenership.
Yeah. Good.
Our thoughts are with them.
Thanks for mentioning your dad, by the way, your dad and mom. That was a great story about Selma. We really appreciate it.
Take care. Speak to you again sometime, Phil.
Bye-bye. And that is just about it. I want to tell you that Gideon Levy, one of the most important, certainly one of the best-known writers in Israel, he writes for Haaretz, is going to be at 65 Church Street Tuesday on the 24th of March, that's tomorrow, at 7:30. He's a great writer and a center of many controversies. Gideon Levy is speaking 65 Church Street, 7:30 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday. He writes for Haaretz, that's the Cathedral Church of St. James. And at any rate, for the Taylor Report, I'm Taylor. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And Andy, thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.